Sports Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, back on Sunday this week and coming to you each and every Sunday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ, KMJ580.com. Each week we visit with local veterans of World War II to honor their service to our country during that difficult time, to preserve those stories for posterity, and hopefully to inspire our younger Americans to serve with the same kind of selflessness and sacrifice that the greatest generation embodied. I do want to remind you, next Sunday, we're only 1 week away now from the big concert in downtown Fresno. The Sounds of Freedom Band will be hosting a concert next Sunday at 2 o'clock at the William Saroyan Theater. It is free admission. They'll be accepting donations. But if you want to hear your military song, you want to hear a lot of patriotic music, you want to go out with a bunch of people who love America and get encouraged on a Sunday afternoon, be there next Sunday, 2 o'clock at the Saroyan Theater for the Sounds of Freedom Band. You'll probably hear a little snippet of that band's music before this show is over today. I'm very excited to have on the program today a good friend of mine and a gentleman that I met while I was tracking World War II veterans down on the television side. Tony Augustine of Lemon Cove is here today. Tony has one of the more incredible stories that I think I've ever had a chance to listen to, and hopefully by the end of this program today you are going to get a taste of that as well. Let's start early on, Tony. You didn't grow up in Lemon Cove. You grew up in Cleveland, Ohio.
That is correct, yes.
And in about 1936, you decided to join the CCC?
Yes, that's right.
That's the Civilian Conservation Corps for those younger folks out there.
I volunteered to go in there. That was during the Depression time. President Roosevelt had that for the to help the families cope with their financial burdens. And they let these young people go to these Civilian Conservation Corps camps. And it was $30 a month. $25 went to the parents, and $5 was kept by the individual at the camp. So I joined mine. And previous to that, my oldest brother, Joseph Augustine, he's now deceased, he went to Fresno, California, worked in Yosemite Park in the Three C's. And when I volunteered, I had the address on my orders, Fresno again. I said, oh, I'm going to California. This was from Cleveland, and I was so overjoyed, and then we looked closer to it. It was Fresno, Ohio. That set me down quite a bit.
A lot of people don't even know that there is a Fresno, Ohio, but it's about, what, an hour's drive from Cleveland?
It's about 60 miles from Cleveland, yes.
So that was a bit of a disappointment.
Oh, it was. I wanted to go reach out to the world. As a youngster, that's all you do is dream about getting to faraway places. And, well, things turned out for the better. I did see a lot.
Well, and you're in Fresno today here sitting with me, and I'm glad that you are. And you did see quite a bit of the world between then and now. You ended up in the military in 1940, is that right?
October 10th, 1940. I enlisted at Fort Hays, Columbus, Ohio. And yeah, part of an infantry battalion or regiment, I don't know which at this time. And that was a military installation. I enlisted there. And I was sent to Panama on the Panama Canal, Fort Clayton, on the Pacific side for basic training with the 33rd Infantry Regiment. And thereafter, our training was completed. We had work as transit guards on ships that were going through the canal from the Pacific to the Atlantic and back. And also, we had lock guard, where we were stationed on the locks in case of sabotage, and we were armed, of course. But it was very important for the work done on transit guard because of the situation. There were Japanese, German, and Italian ships, and they were taboo for us. We were always worried about sabotage in the locks of the canal. So
well,
we were very
point,
alert.
At this point, some of those countries are at war. The United States is not yet in the war yet.
No, Germany was at war in Poland already, and Japan was tied closely to Germany. Mm-hmm. And Italy, of course, is a friend,
right.
Close friend.
But for the moment, the United States, anyway, was not openly in combat anywhere in the world.
No open conflict, no.
So that had to be an interesting dynamic for you at the time.
It was. And Panama is a very interesting place for me. It's the first time I was ever in a jungle. And we were working on trails cutting across the Isthmus of Panama with the one company at a time. We'd go 44 miles through the jungle cutting trails through there. There were no roads.
That sounds like a big enough adventure for that adventurous kid from Cleveland.
That's when I saw my first large boa constrictors, and it sent a chill through me. But we had a first sergeant. His name was Carl Porter. He had 30 years of service in at the time. And he was also a distinguished marksman. He fired every year at Camp Perry, Ohio, for the national rifle title.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a man that had no fear of snakes. There was one big boa across our trail. I jumped back, and he just went with a machete there and hacked it over the head. That wasn't for me. I still have a fear of large snakes. I don't like them.
I imagine being down there in Panama, you got face-to-face with a lot of different kinds of tropical wildlife.
Oh, there were a lot of iguanas were over there. In fact, they eat those readily, the Panamanians do. I tried to catch one when I got there, and I went climbed up part of a tree and got thorns on my shoes, scratched all my new Garrison shoes up and ripped part of my pants. That's all that young blood that somebody wants to get out and do the thing that nobody else does. But it didn't pay for me at that time.
I think once upon a time I saw a picture of you with a monkey in Panama, too.
Yeah. Well, that was in Dutch Guiana.
That was in Dutch Guiana.
Yeah,
okay.
We had these small banana monkeys. They're 8 inches, 9 inches long, very small. And we tried to catch them, and the natives had a setup. They would get a bottle and stick sugar inside the bottle, just pieces of sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And and tie the bottle down. And these little monkeys would come in and reach their paw inside and grab the sugar, try to pull it out, and they can't because the fist was held closed. They wouldn't let go.
Mm-hmm.
So all he done was pick them up.
Oh, that's a pretty good way to trap them. Ingenious. And during this time, you're also learning how to, you talked about Carl Porter and his marksmanship. You were learning to be a pretty decent shot yourself, right?
I was an expert marksman over there. First time I fired, we had 6 weeks of basic training on firing.
Mm-hmm.
It done me real good. I never fired a weapon in my life before that. And I hit 198 out of 200, which was 200, 300, and 500 marks series of shots that we had there. So that was great for me. I learned something.
Now, I know you were a pretty good young baseball player growing up in Ohio, too. Did you get to play any ball in the military?
Oh, yes. When I came to Panama, I was with the regimental baseball team. And the first time that I played, there was a medical captain for the medical corps. He was pitching, and I hit one back, I mean, really hard, right into his stomach, knocked him down. That was the first time I was up. I never forget that. He fell down. I could have walked to first base. He was breathing in pain. But I'd done boxing over there, too, in middleweight. I didn't mention that to you.
Well, you probably didn't want to scare me.
Well, no. You know, you're young, and you do everything. You try everything. I was pretty good, though.
Our listeners are going to learn just how much you were willing to try by the time this program's over today. There are some incredible things that I can't imagine trying myself. So stay tuned for some of that. Now, let me ask you this, Tony. Obviously, you're playing baseball, you're boxing, you're exploring through the jungle. This is pretty adventurous. What changed when Pearl Harbor happened? Was there an immediate change in your position in the military and what you had to do in the atmosphere?
Well, we were dumbfounded when it happened. And patriotism, the blood just surges through the head and heart. I mean, you want to do something for your country. And that's, I would say 99 or 9/10 of the people have that feeling. We were regular Army. We were not draftees. And I think we showed 100% of patriotism, though, for the military. We were really dumbfounded. In fact, when I enlisted in 1940, I wanted to go to the farthest place that the military had. I volunteered for the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And they had the 32nd or 31st Regiment there. Hawaii had the other,
mm-hmm.
32nd or 31st. I volunteered for the Philippines, no openings, and then I volunteered for Hawaii, no openings there. Panama was the only thing that I could get into. And it was my luck that I did go to Panama because 1941 Pearl Harbor happened and, you know, Bataan.
That's
and
right.
All the fighting in the Philippines. So it was a lucky stroke for me.
If there had been an opening, you might have been on the Bataan Death March or at Pearl Harbor on December 7th.
I was lucky in that respect.
Well, I'm glad you were, and I'm glad you're here talking to me. We're going to catch our first commercial break here. There is so much more to come with Tony Augustine's story. We're going to find out how he ended up in Italy with the 310th Engineers, some of the things that he did, some of the death-defying things that he did, some of the brazenly bold and maybe ill-advised things that he attempted in the service of our country in Europe, and how he lived to tell about it and share this visit with us today. Tony Augustine, our guest this time on Hometown Heroes. We'll be right back on News Talk 580 KMJ. You won't find the town of Alveston on any map of the valley, and no, it's not in Texas either, but it is on the World Wide Web. Go to alveston.com and take a tour of the virtual town where the grass is green, the water's clean, and electricity won't cost you a thing. Whether you prefer red states or blue states, you'll see the value of building green. Go to alveston.com, that's A-L-V-I-S-T-O-N.com, to see for yourself how you can save your money and save your planet at the same time. Alveston.com, your source for green construction.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Shoo, 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 baby. Shoo, 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 baby. Ba, 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 baby. Da, da, da. Your papa's off to the seven seas. Don't cry, baby.
You remember the Andrews sisters? Tony Augustine remembers the Andrews sisters very well. In fact, another one of their songs was about one of the stops that you made. You were among the first American troops in Trinidad, is that right?
Well, our company, Company E, of the 33rd Infantry Regiment from Panama, they sent us to Trinidad on that lend-lease setup that the U.S. set up with England or Britain. Whereas we gave 50 old-age destroyers from World War I to the British, they in turn let us lease all the possessions that they had, the Dutch, the French later, and the British. So we had British, French, and Dutch Guiana with us, Trinidad, Tobago, all the islands through Martinique, and we were assigned to Trinidad for security purposes and to build a airfield for the Army Air Corps. There was no Air Force at that time. It was Air Corps.
Right.
And we were security for that area there. And just about 3 or 4 miles away from this air base was what the Andrews sisters were singing about in their rum and Coca-Cola song, Manzanilla Beach, a beautiful sand beach, large coconut trees, coconuts all over the place. We really enjoyed the scenic area of Trinidad.
Oh, yeah, this is sounding like a pretty good vacation here. You're just hanging out in the tropics.
Yeah, it was really nice. And we done our work. We had to do security, and that was a good job for us.
We're talking to Tony Augustine of Lemon Cove, and after he was done down there in the tropics, he would be sent to North Africa with the 310th Engineers attached to the 85th Infantry Division. Was that where you first kind of got the real taste of what the war was going to be like for you?
Well, yes, it was. That was our. We came in, landed geographically. I think you'd say east of Casablanca, toward the Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went over to Arzu in Saint Denis du Sig, and we had to. Pulled back, and we had to get our training for mine warfare and demolitions. That's what we were specializing in.
Well, that sounds like fun. No danger there.
That was my specialty. And throughout the war, that's all we done was pick up mines. As an example, when in the Italian front, we had to get out ahead of the artillery barrage and clear up the minefields. Excuse me, and open up, take the concertina wire away. That's that barbed wire that they had around.
Right.
We had to clear the area so the infantry could get through. This is right on the front perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
And those things were, you kind of think about it. I had one mine blew, it didn't blow up, but it went into the air. It was an S mine. My toes hit it. We were probing with bayonets. We didn't have the mine detectors at that time. And my the toe of one shoe hit that mine. It has three prongs on it. And it must have touched it and went up into the air because it's in a canister. And when the gas forms inside the mine, it blows the top portion up in the air. And that has three sections of TNT in it and about 300 steel balls. And that thing jumped in, went into the air and landed right by my feet and smoking. And I took off with my buddy. He was next to me. We ran through the minefield up a hill. And we never hit anything with our buddies. We were very fortunate.
What are the chances of that?
Well, that's something, you know, when one of those things go off, you're looking at some problems.
You don't know where the rest of the mines are, but you know where that one is, so you better get away from it.
What we've done is when they clear a minefield, they will have a white tracing tape on either side. One person, there's a margin person on each side, and the inside perimeter, people stay side by side and probe with their with the bayonets and pick up S mines. If you could hit a teller mine in between, you have to pull them out.
Now, and I've seen you move around. You're going to be 88 in November, and I've seen you play soccer with my little daughter, Avery. In fact, she still remembers that.
Talk she about beat me.
I don't know about that. But I think the first time you told me about this instance that you're talking about, that you and your friend Fred Young are defusing these
Young,
mines,
yeah.
that you ran so fast, it sucked him up the hill behind
you?
He said,
I must have pulled him up just through the wind.
Now, did you enjoy that kind of work? Because to me, that sounds like you're going out to play Russian roulette every day.
Frankly, I did enjoy it. I did enjoy it because when you're young, you like danger. Not that you want to get killed, but you know it's nothing's going to happen to you personally.
I think you like danger a little more than some of the rest of us.
I think there's a lot of them felt the same way. Not bravery involved, just that you like to take a chance. Just like parachutists when they jump out of planes.
Sure.
That thing could collapse and they're gone, but they love it.
How many mines do you think you pulled out of the ground in your time in Europe?
I'd say totally, I would guess around 3,000 mines.
Holy cow. And they trained you to, because there are different types of mines you'd encounter, teller mines that you talked
about.
Well,
the teller mine I believe it had 11 pounds of TNT in it. It was a flat mine,
right.
And it had the cap on top, a flat cap. And they would stand pressure of over 240 pounds, I believe. I'm not 100% sure on it now.
And they had the bouncing Bettys, too, that were an issue?
Those were the S mines, the bouncing Bettys.
Yeah.
But the teller mine, they would bury those underneath the ground. And sometimes, but very rarely, the Germans would put another, they'd put a another mine underneath. And they would also have, what do you call them? My mind is not functioning properly.
Well, I was just curious if in your training in North Africa, if they gave you examples of all these mines and told you the different ways to remove the different kinds of mines, or if you were operating a lot on guesswork out there.
Yes, we were. And when I look at it now, I think many times what I did was foolish. But then I look back with pride and say, well, I accomplished something.
And you earned a nickname along this time?
Lucky, they called me Lucky. I had that for a long time. Everybody wanted to stay with me. And I was telling about those S mines. They would put a push-pull mechanism underneath or between two mines. And when you picked up the mine, the first one, you would blow up the second one.
And you, right.
Instead of 11 pounds, you got 22 pounds of TNT going.
They were pretty good at laying booby traps here and there, weren't they?
Though they were kind of rare, though. That's why we never bothered looking, you know, to get a rope and pull them. You didn't have time. You get a whole platoon of guys, they're walking along the perimeters, and most of the times you can see indentures in the ground from rain.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, there's a mine there, a teller mine. But the S mine was different. They had that even with the dirt. And three little prongs sticking up, you couldn't tell them. And you just step on it with your foot, and that's it. It goes up in the air and explodes.
Well, someone must have been guiding your footsteps when you were running through that minefield.
Oh, yeah. That was a lucky shot. And somewhere, now, I think it was by Vergato, Italy, we were sitting on the, in the mountains. It was the Apennine Mountains chain.
Right.
And we were sitting on the crest of one of the high hills there, looking down, and way below, I talked to my buddy. I saw a rabbit jumping, and I said, I'm gonna hit that rabbit. I picked up a stone. It was about 6 inches,
yeah,
almost rounded. And I threw that thing down, and it kept bouncing 10, 15, 20 feet in the air and just cascading down toward the rabbit, and it landed right on top of the rabbit, killed it.
I hopefully the SPCA isn't going to come after you for that. That's the statute of limitations.
Well, that was food. We didn't go there. It was too far down to get it, though.
What was it like, just the day-to-day life of you and the guys in your division? What was your outlook like, and did you have that kind of that camaraderie, that fellowship that kind of helped you keep going?
Very close.
Yeah.
Very close. I had this guy that I told you about, Fred Young, my friend from Brooklyn. Then I had another guy, I can't think of his name now. I'm getting old, so they have to forgive me. But he was another good friend of mine from the Catskills in New York.
Uh-huh.
And everything that he said was combat. That's all he would say. He wanted to be into the spirit. And I wrote a little song for him, just something we got on. I still remember it.
You going to sing it for us?
Yeah, it went something like this. Everyone in town sings Van Van, the combat man. In every village and town, it's Van Van, the combat man. You never have to worry. You never have to worry. Oh, you never have to worry. Our victory will be won because we have a man like Van to tote a combat gun. When he's walking down the street, everybody stomps their feet to Van Van, the combat man. I made that up for him. He wrote it and sent it to his wife.
He got a kick out of it, huh?
Oh, yeah.
That's great. Nicely done there. We need to catch another commercial break here, but when we come back, we're going to talk to Tony about bridges. You think engineer units, you think bridges, you think building bridges, but what about saving bridges? Could one man be responsible for saving a bridge that still stands today? We're going to get the answer to that when we come back. Hometown Heroes continues next on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
You've heard that one a time or two, so has Tony Augustine. And if you want to hear that performed in person by the group performing on that recording, go to the Soroyan Theater 1 week from today, next Sunday, September the 14th at 2 o'clock, a free concert by the Sounds of Freedom Band, a local band made up of people from age 15 to 90. There are some World War II veterans in that band. In fact, we've had some of them on this program. But 2 o'clock next Sunday, William Soroyan Theater in downtown Fresno for a concert. They will be accepting donations with those proceeds going to support troops returning from Iraq and Afghanistan and all over our world. So Sounds of Freedom Band in concert next Sunday at 2. Let's continue now with Tony Augustine of Lemon Cove. Now, I told you there was a story about a bridge here. I'm just going to read you a quote from the Custer Combateer, Volume 1, Number 3, May of 1945, a newspaper printed for soldiers in Europe after the war was ending. This says, and this happened in late April of 1945, as leading elements of the 85th Division swept toward the Panaro River, this is in Italy, the last barrier before the Po River, men of the 3rd Battalion of the 337th driving toward the bridge at Camposanto met stiff resistance from the waiting Germans. Something had to be done, and quickly, Lieutenant Cecil H. Cates was sent ahead to make a recon in a tank. As he approached the bridge, enemy anti-tank guns opened up on him. In the face of severe enemy fire, he got out of the tank, captured 5 German prisoners, and warned the troops that the bridge had been mined and might be blown. Corporal Anthony J. Augustine of B Company, 310th Engineers, offered to swim the river and cut the demolition wires. Lieutenant Thomas Buck of 85th Recon went with Augustine to cover him from the near bank. Corporal Augustine stripped, slipped into the icy depth, and struck out for the other bank. About midway across, they spotted him. Slugs hit dangerously near the swimmer. Lieutenant Buck opened fire. He shot one of the Germans and silenced their guns. In the meantime, Augustine reached the far bank, hurriedly cut the wires leading to the explosives, and swam back. Today, the bridge is marked. You are crossing this bridge through the courtesy of the 85th Infantry Division, 310th Engineers. Now, that was from a newspaper back then. You also have a citation. You were awarded the Silver Star for what you did in April, on April 22nd of 1945. And that Silver Star citation calls what you faced an intense hail of enemy fire. This sounds crazy. How did this happen, and where did you get the courage and the boldness, that brazen attitude, to try something like that?
Well, as I mentioned to you before, my company commander is Captain Lowell Miller. He's from Virginia. He picked me up, and we went on reconnaissance to see what bridges were still over the Panaro, and that was the only bridge that was left. Two divisions crossed over that bridge. You're talking about 40,000 people with equipment.
The 85th Infantry and the 88th Infantry Division.
Yeah. They both crossed that bridge, and General Colter was looking for the person that saved the bridge there. But I was gone. I was in a farmhouse drinking wine, wet, cold, and feeling pretty good until the next morning. Then I got the little jitters because I was wondering what foolishness I did. But before that happened, I had some wine also before that. I was always looking for wine.
Uh-huh.
Get to drink that.
Well, you were in Italy.
Yeah. And those things happen.
You had a little wine, and all of a sudden, you're ready to take the world by storm.
The wine gave me the courage. False courage, I guess you might call it.
Describe that. I just read that account of it, but let's hear it from your point of view. What do you remember seeing as you approached that Panaro River?
I saw an embankment there, and the bridge, and this lieutenant that I told him to cover me. I looked at that, and I saw the wires dangling from the other side, and I said, that bridge is mine. And I told him to cover me, that I was going to go in there. So I jumped into the water and started swimming across. We always carried side cutters, you know, small pliers.
What are all the rest of you guys in your outfit doing at this time?
They were back in another area. I was on reconnaissance with this captain.
So you're out headed by your...
I wasn't even with this outfit.
But there are guys in this outfit who are hunkered down there, right?
That was the 85th Reconnaissance Group.
And they're not trying to do anything
to
the bridge.
No, they didn't. They were laying there. I came in with this captain. They were all in a prone position and not doing it, not moving.
Because the Germans had the bridge and had guns.
That's right.
Okay.
So when I was over there, I got up and started zigzagging, racing toward the barn.
There's a barn on the embankment?
Yeah, the barn next to a house.
Uh-huh.
And I opened up the door, and five Germans came out. And these were the ones that Gates said he took as prisoners. They were actually mine.
Okay.
But I wasn't there to contest anything. I was already out of the service.
Well, maybe you left them with him while you went to the river, huh?
But anyway, these people came out. The prisoners, and I told them in German, I said, the war is over for you. That's it, because I could speak German.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, I married a German. My wife was German.
Well, we're going to get to that before we're done
but,
on the show, too.
What happened was, ironically, when the others came up, when the firing died down, and one young man from that recon company, he didn't know what was behind the tarp. There was a trailer with a tarp over it, like these one-ton... Mm-hmm. Traders, you see these square jobs, and he fired into it. Boy, I was upset about that. That thing was full of TNT.
Holy cow.
Now, if that was dynamite, we'd have been gone. TNT don't normally go with a blast from a gun. But that really upset me about it. You never can tell when there's a lot of people around. Everybody has their own way of doing things, and sometimes they're wrong.
All right, take us through this, though. You get up on the top of this riverbank, and you see these wires dangling from the bridge. You know that if they blow the bridge, it's really going to slow you guys down.
I knew that.
And you just decide, I'm diving in?
Yes. In fact, when I saw those wires at the position that I was in, if it had blown up, it would have got me anyway.
So it was no turning back at this point.
Because they must have had a ton and a half of TNT in that thing, at least.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that goes a long way.
Yeah.
And those wires were dangling there, and I never cut so many wires in my life. I thought I must have cut 20.
Well, you had to get there first. I mean, this is not just a little creek where you're three strokes and you're across. You had to swim a little ways,
well, my
and they're
strokes,
shooting at you.
My strokes were plentiful, but not gaining much. I just kept paddling away. You know, when you want to go fast, you just can't make it.
You grew up swimming in Lake Erie, or what?
Yeah, I could swim.
Uh-huh.
But I'm saying when you're in a rut like that, you're trying to make real progress, you just don't coordinate right.
Could you tell there were bullets hitting the water next to you?
Pardon?
Could you tell that bullets were hitting the water next to you?
I could hear them.
Uh-huh.
And that's what woke me up, the shell fire. And I said, man, it's too late to turn. You have to get back. And I just kept cutting those things and hoping that nothing would hit me. But every time I cut one of those wires, flashing through my mind, why, I got to get the rest. And just working your way through it.
How many wires do you think there were?
There were six or seven of them.
So you're
on the abutment. The abutment is the part where the bridge rests on.
Exactly.
The land.
Yep.
And that's where they blow them up so you can't repair them.
Mm-hmm.
That was something, though. General Coulter was sure looking for me at that time. He couldn't find me. He was later on the commanding general of all forces in Korea.
What did it mean to you when you got that Silver Star?
Frankly, I didn't really care much about it. I mean, I wasn't really impressed. Everybody else was. You know, the family, they're all proud of me. I was proud of it, but I mean, I'm never one to say, ooh, I got this, I've got this.
You were glad you were alive.
Yeah, I was happy. I always think positive on things like that.
And they gave you the Silver Star, not just because you
Well, what happened was they sent me a letter and say they wanted to put a formal presentation at Fort Knox, Fort Hays, Columbus, Ohio, or Cryle General Hospital in Cleveland, a veterans hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have a parade, and I rode back and said, I don't want it. So then one day, a lieutenant came in with a package that compliments of the War Department. And they gave me the Silver Star. And he took off.
Well, that's
but
the...
I still have the card from that signed by the Secretary of War, Patterson.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't Secretary of Defense. It was Secretary of War at that time.
It was before the Defense Department, you bet. Well, and they gave the Silver Star to you not just because of your heroism and your bravery and your complete lack of concern for your own safety, but that was a big deal. Two divisions crossed over that bridge.
Kept the advance going.
Mm-hmm.
And we went there to the Po River, and then we overran German commanding general. I can't think of his name. He's an Air Force general. It'll come to me in a minute. I told you, old age is creeping up on me.
Well, and what I'm trying to get to is this was...
It was Field Marshal Albert Kesselring.
Yep.
He was commanding general of all forces in Italy, German forces. We overran his position. He had a bunker underground because our bombers and planes were always strafing.
Mm-hmm.
And we ran in there. Of course, it was abandoned, and I found his stamp collection there. And like a fool, I gave it to another kid because I didn't know stamp was for grown-ups.
Well,
it was a beautiful, thick book, all of them. He was an Air Force general. They traveled all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And he had some good stamps. I collect stamps now.
Well, you collect a lot of things. I've seen some of the great memorabilia you have from the war. Let me ask you this, Tony, before we catch our final commercial break here and talk about the rest of your story, or at least as much as we can fit into this program. That bridge, the Campo Santo, as far as we know, that is still there today. And Campo Santo is a very small town in Italy. Have you ever thought about going back to visit that bridge that you saved in April of 1945?
I longed many a time that I wanted to go back there. But since I retired, and at this age, I'm mobile enough to go. But, you know, on a sergeant's pay... in the military is not the highest amount. It's not a general's pay. So I just get by. I've got my 2 acres that I work in Lemon Cove. It has citrus in it. Keeps me physically happy and mentally. And if I had the chance and the funds to do it, I would gladly go. But time is running out.
Well,
you never know. After you hit 88, you don't know what's happening. You go from week to week, month to month.
You're going to be 88 in November, yeah. Maybe between now and then.
But if there was some good-hearted Samaritan somewhere that would sponsor me on a trip, I would sure love it.
Well, we'll see what we can do about that. We'll look into that idea. I'd love to see you go back there and visit that bridge that you saved all those years ago. Maybe I'll find a way to go with you. We need to catch our final commercial break here. When we come back, there's another pretty interesting part of Tony Augustine's story. I think you'll think so anyway. We'll be right back with more Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Tell us about your hometown hero. Email your story by clicking on the Hometown Heroes link at kmj580.com.
Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we get the Alamo. We will always remember how they died for liberty. Let's remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory.
The Sammy Kay Orchestra, Remember Pearl Harbor. Tony Augustine remembers December 7th. He wasn't in Hawaii. He might have been if the government hadn't denied his request to be sent there. Instead, he ended up in Panama, later in Europe with the 310th Engineers attached to the 85th Infantry Division. If you've been listening to this program, you've heard him talk about saving that bridge on the Panaro River in Camposanto, Italy. That earned him the Silver Star. But the Silver Star wasn't the one thing he brought home from the war that he was most proud of. That would still be to come, because he stayed behind in Europe after the war. And you ended up... let me get this story straight. Now, you were writing for the Stars and Stripes at the time? Is that what you were doing?
Yes, I was with Stars and Stripes.
And you went to a circus? Or a carnival?
It was a high-wire performance that they were presenting to the American troops on the 4th of July. This was about 3 miles from the town of Funkstadt, where Stars and Stripes was situated at that time.
Uh-huh.
And I went over to this place in Darmstadt and watched the show. And lo and behold, I met somebody.
Well, you're watching the show, and you see this pretty little thing up on the high wire doing the high wire act.
Yes.
And you decided you weren't going to leave her alone?
That's right. I went after her tooth and nail. And this thing lasted from 48 to 52 until we got married.
So you just kept hounding her. You wouldn't take no for an answer.
They were on the road all the time, traveling and performing. And I had to find out what town they were in. I went all over Germany on weekend passes, 3-day passes. That's how it is when you're in love.
And her family had been in Europe before the war. In fact, she had a brother that the Germans were after to get in their army, right?
Yes, they had, it was an uncle of hers.
Okay.
He was 21 years old. And they just drafted him and put him into service. And my father-in-law, he was a performer. And they performed for the German services or whatever. They could work for the government. They got paid for it. And he tried to save his brother from going into the service to no avail. And the young kid was 21 years old, very good performer. And it was a matter of a couple of months or so, he got killed in the Ukraine. Didn't know anything about the military. They just threw him in there, cannon fodder.
So when you start pursuing this this young lady, Alexandrine Alexa, as you know her now,
yeah,
how did her family feel about this American who was chasing her down?
Well, they liked me. I got along fine with them right from the beginning. What a face like that only a mother could really love.
Okay, when we told your story on television, I had your wife talking about some of this, too, and going back and forth and how the story progressed. But I really enjoyed the story about how you ended up finally, after those 4 years you talked about, proposing to her.
Uh-huh.
Share that with our listeners. How did you propose to your wife?
Well, I gave her a toast to drink in a little glass and told her to drink it, and she was reluctant.
She didn't even drink wine.
No,
right?
that's true.
Uh-huh.
She was reluctant to take it, and I said she has to, and she drank it down, and inside was our engagement ring. So she took that, and that was the beginning of, what is it, since 52, it's 56 years.
Not bad, not bad. And her family continued to perform a high wire artist.
Yeah, in fact, my father-in-law was the first one in the world to run a motorcycle on a high wire.
So you weren't the only one in the family who was a little... little too crazy and too bold.
Well, he was known for doing things like that. He was a real good performer.
And they performed, this is the Lemoyne's troupe, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
They performed all over the world?
Oh, yeah. They were, well, we were in the States here for quite a few years.
Mm-hmm.
I got them over. And Dad, before, they worked in Canada, throughout the States, a lot of the state fairs, Australia. Sydney, Australia at the Royal Easter Show. In Tokyo, they played there, Venezuela, Mexico, Puerto Rico, and all the Western European countries they worked in them. Even in North Africa, in Algiers one time.
They ever try to talk you into going on the high wire?
Well, they couldn't talk me into it because I didn't care for it. I knew one step and I'm gone.
That's the same thing as a minefield.
Yeah, but not quite. The minefield, you can walk away from this thing, you fall. But it was fun, though. We met a lot of people and enjoyed it. We never got rich, but we did live comfortably.
You finally ended up coming back to the States, bringing her along with you.
Yeah.
And you end up in Hollywood working for Armed Forces Radio and TV?
That's right, yeah.
What was that like?
It was wonderful. I met a lot of people. We had services over there. Many of the stars on radio and TV made recordings of shows.
Mm-hmm.
And those went out to the armed forces. They were printed right in Hollywood. And we met all of Bing Crosby, Raymond Burr. And Raymond Burr was a good friend of ours. And we had Edward G. Robinson, Harry Lockman, a whole bunch of the people from the studios. They came to the studios, rather. And they wanted to do their bit. They were also patriotic.
Were those there any of those people that maybe one of those celebrity Hollywood types that kind of really stood out in your mind as a very genuine person and someone that...
Raymond Burr, we liked him. He used to come every week, once or twice, and occasionally he would take us to Paramount Studios and to their commissary, where the restaurant where they ate. Mm-hmm. And he'd give us a lavish meal and charge it to the... company. But he was a real nice fellow, and we also met
did you ever ask him if he was ever going to lose a case on TV?
He did.
Eventually he did, that's right.
But we had Nick Clooney, Rosemary Clooney's brother.
Uh-huh.
He was at Armed Forces Radio and over there, and Raymond Burr was also a captain of American Armed Forces Radio.
All
this
right.
Is right after the war ended.
Uh-huh.
Then he went ahead, Draper Lewis from NBC, and there were quite a few of them that came in.
A lot of adventures.
Yeah, a lot of people in there. Johnny Brotsis from Philadelphia.
When you look back now, and we've heard you talk about how when you got into the service, you wanted to go to the Philippines. The Army said, nope, no room. You wanted to go Hawaii, no room. You could have been on the Bataan Death March. You could have been at Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
You miss out on both of those. You go to Europe. You pull 3,000 mines. None of them get you. You'd swim in a river with the Germans shooting at you and defuse the bombs on a bridge that would have blown it. You dodge another bullet there, come home with a Silver Star, and you end up meeting your wife.
Yeah.
So any one of those things changes. You're not sitting here today, and you don't have your wife for 56 years.
It's fate.
Uh-huh.
And the ironic thing is that I've seen Hawaii and the Philippines after that.
A lot better than they would have looked at that time.
I've been fortunate. I've been in over 40 different countries, and that was good.
What are you most proud of when you think back of your time in the service in World War II?
I think of the war years. You hate to see it, but it's something when you're with a group of people, fellows, comrades, that you eat, sleep, and fight with.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see two or three of them go down, And then you look back and say, geez, I beat the odds. It's something that just keeps you going. Say, I can keep going. I beat it. To me, that's how I felt. Mm-hmm. And bravery is not a factor in the whole thing. You either have to be a little out of your mind or in fear, panic of some kind to make you want to do things that you shouldn't do. Everybody's up against the wall when that something like that happens. In me, I had wine. I had some wine. I think it made me a little stronger than what I wanted to be.
Well, those two entire divisions that crossed over that bridge, we're thankful that you did. We're out of time for this program, but Tony, thank you so much for your service to our country and for all the things that you do today. He's got a big heart, and he's a great part of our valley. Go visit him in Lemon Cove sometime. He'll be happy to have you. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes again today on News Talk 580 KMJ.